So hi everyone, I'm Aidan, and I'm an MVP with what's now called the Cloud and Data Center Management Expertise. I call it Hyper-V. I'm a subset of CDM. CDM was always a system center thing, but now we're all one big blob because we're seen as one solution. And my day job, I am technical sales lead at an Irish distributor called Micro Warehouse, which has nothing to do with the Micro Warehouse here in the UK. And there I learn about stuff. My job's very similar to Ed's. I learn about stuff, do the stuff, teach the stuff. And every now and then I get to go out in customer sites and help people do the stuff. But my job is to work with Microsoft partners in Ireland and Northern Ireland. And I blog on aidenfinn.com, contributing editor on Microsoft Virtualization for the Petri IT Knowledge Base. And if you want to get spammed, I'm on Twitter as @Joe_Elway, where you can learn about Irish traffic and the faults with Irish Airlines and stuff like that. And occasionally I'll talk about virtualization and Azure. And yeah, sometimes the VMware marketing people try to assault me. Now, we're going to be talking about Windows Server 2016 Hyper-V and the related technologies. So we're going to be covering clustering, we're going to be covering storage, we're going to be covering networking, we're going to be covering other new things as well, like containers and Microsoft Azure Stack. But I'm going to warn you in advance. Actors say that you should never work with children or animals. Technology presenters will tell you never work with beta products. Worse than a beta product is a technical preview, where you've got alpha code, not just beta code, alpha code. Stuff that isn't coming out in the next release or the next release, maybe even the next release. So this presentation is cursed. My demo labs blew up on me on Monday, and I had to restore everything onto another physical host, and did, and then all my scripts were wacky, and I had to fix it all up, and then it blew up again yesterday, and then one of my particular demos blew up completely. And then I found out there was bugs in TP3, or Technical Preview 3, which is the current preview build of Windows Server 2016. So I think everything's working, but you may see some alarms and failures. And if that's what happens, that's what happens. And then I caught my flight this morning, which I barely got to because a 40-minute drive to the airport took 3.5 hours. And then while I was on the airplane, I thought, okay, nice. They give me breakfast. That's lovely. I love British Airways. Got my breakfast, opened up the orange, and it went all over my shirt. Thankfully, Ed gave me a nice clean shirt. So let's talk about security. If you're interested in cloud computing at all, whether it's private cloud on-premise in a large enterprise, or putting something into a hosting partner's cloud, or Azure, or whatever, I'm calling it Azure. So that's Azure for most people, but I got caught in the American thing. Security is a big deal. I used to work in hosting. I worked for two different hosting companies, and the way I looked at my tenants was I could not trust them. They ran hostile code. I could not trust them on my infrastructure, and I could not trust them in relation to each other, so we needed to isolate them as much as possible. I am a hosting customer, so I do not trust the hosting company. I do not want them looking at my stuff. And a lot of Europeans have that view of public clouds. They don't trust the operators. They don't trust the hosting company itself. We always need to assume the worst, and some people just assume the worst anyway. So what Microsoft are doing is they're introducing the concept of shielded virtual machines. And the concept here is the data and the state of the virtual machine are protected from inspection by the hosting company, the operators, the administrators, other tenants, and external forces. Is that a drone? You never can tell when you're near an airport. So that's the idea here. So we're protecting the VM state. What does that mean? When the virtual machine is at rest, when it's running, and when it's live migrating across the network, we can encrypt that virtual machine as a tenant. We're getting a virtual TPM chip in the specification of generation 2 virtual machines, which allows us to independently from the hardware and from the hosting company encrypt that virtual machine using BitLocker. We're completely responsible for the recovery keys because the hosting company can't get into the virtual machine. They don't have the administrator credentials, therefore they cannot remote desktop into it. In fact, if we raise up all the shields, because there's two levels of shielding or cloaking with this technology, Microsoft are trying to figure out terminology, and one of them was, well, this level is shielded and this level is cloaked. When we bring up all the level of cloaking, none of the integration components for managing virtual machines will actually work for the hosting companies or the service provider if it's an internal private cloud. Everything will be completely shielded away from those operators, meaning that the tenant is fully isolated and secure from the hosting provider and anyone else who would issue a warrant to that hosting provider. They will therefore have to issue the warrant to the tenant themselves, which would sort out all sorts of legal issues in the US. We also get a hardened hypervisor. So Microsoft had done a lot of work to work on the hypervisor itself. Hyper-V, if you don't know, is tiny. It is a tiny little sliver of software that lives on the hardware. The management OS sits on top of it. All of that has been hardened to create trust levels and isolation between the various different components, whether it's management or orchestration or virtualization, all of it hardened and isolated. Now we've got some other things we have going on as well. So one thing we're worried about is someone taking our virtual machines and putting them onto another infrastructure and powering them up and being able to tamper with them and play with them. We can prevent that with shielded virtual machines. So hosts will have to be attested. Something will have to verify that that host or that cluster is allowed to start up that virtual machine. And if that host is not able to supply the correct certificate, that virtual machine will not start, no matter what. And we get that in two different ways. The first is TPM attested deployment. This is the highest level of attestation, I hate that word, attestation from Hyper-V in 2016. And this relies on your hosts having TPM version 2 chips and UEFI 2.3.1. How many servers out there have TPM v2? Probably zero. The only machines I have seen with TPM v2 are laptops and barebone PC kits. So they're great to test with right now. We expect in the new year we will start to see hardware from the typical vendors with those version 2 TPM chipsets. Those hosts will run in your traditional hosting Active Directory forest. But another forest is deployed. It's a small forest, and its function is to run something called Host Guardian Service, or HGS. And that HGS in the TPM deployment has a hardware security module, or a HSM, for storing secure certificates that can't be tampered with by administrators. The HGS is responsible for issuing those certificates to hosts when they want to start up a virtual machine. So if a shielded virtual machine is powered up, the host can only actually start it if it's able to get a valid certificate from the HGS in that trusted, isolated Active Directory forest. The idea here is a very small number of people will have any rights to that HGS forest, and your normal operators will have admin rights in the hosting environment. Oh, wrong laptop. For an enterprise deployment or for proof of concepts or customers who don't have hosts with TPM v2 chips or UEFI 2.3.1, we can do the admin trusted model. And here we don't have a HSM, we don't have TPM. The hosts continue to run in a hosting Active Directory domain or forest, and the HGS runs in another isolated but trusted forest. Now we are trusting the admins of the HGS forest that they won't go into the certificate stores and start tampering with the certificates. But at least we're reducing the number of administrators who will have access to those particular certificates. So what we're getting out of this is, with shielded virtual machines, those virtual machines can only run on authorized hosts. So if someone lifts the virtual machine and puts it somewhere else, it won't start up. Tenants can limit or even restrict any visibility into the virtual machine. So if I don't want to let the hosting company or the private cloud administrators to see into my virtual machine, I can raise my shields. I can cloak my virtual machine. I can encrypt it. And keep in mind that if I do implement BitLocker, only I, the tenant, have access to those keys. The hosting provider cannot decrypt my virtual machine. So make sure you implement some sort of solution for recovering your Active or your keys in Active Directory or using MBAM. An interesting concept we've been working with over the last few years is convergence, particularly of networking. Windows Server 2012 allows us, without having to buy £20,000 worth of special switches for blade servers, It allows us to converge various different networks into fewer NICs, typically with higher bandwidth. We're talking about 10 gig or faster networking, which, by the way, the switching for that is getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. I saw a small medium enterprise 10 gig switch for under £800 a couple of weeks ago, which starts making 10 gig networking look more and more interesting. So typically with a 2008 or two or older host, we would deploy lots of 1 gig NICs and NIC teams, making sure we followed the NIC teaming doctrine correctly. And we could have as many as 12 or 14 NICs there to do all the various different things. With 2012 and later, when we start converging networks, we could have as few as one NIC if we didn't want any NIC fault tolerance. Realistically, we do want load balancing and failover, so we deploy two NICs. Now, other things that Microsoft introduced with 2012 or two included the ability to do hardware offloading for networking traffic. So things like remote direct memory access, or RDMA, allows us to push huge amounts of data with low latency across 10 gig or faster networking, up to 100 gig these days, and no processor impact, or no noticeable processor impact. When you start pushing 10 or 20 gig of data without RDMA, you start impacting the processor significantly. RDMA is fantastic, and 2012 or 2 actually uses it for live migration. So in my demo lab, I'm able to push virtual machines around at 40 gigabits per second, fully utilizing that bandwidth, and my processor utilization goes up maybe 1%. Now try do that with other hypervisors and see what happens. You won't get those benefits. You'll be hit badly, and you'll pay a cost. The downside with RDMA is it could not be converged. So we had to deploy a design like on the left-hand side. We now had four 10 gig NICs. Now the promise of 10 gig and faster networking is two NICs, two switch ports, reduce infrastructure costs, reduce power costs, reduce heating costs, etc., etc., etc. In 2016, we are seeing something different. The Hyper-V switch is going to have embedded uplinks, which means we don't have to deploy NIC teaming beneath the Hyper-V switch as we do in 2012 or 2012 or 2. So that's switch embedded teaming. Think of it as being like a physical switch on the top of your rack that has a pair of uplink ports. The virtual switch will have very similar, with the same load balancing failover functionality that is typically best practice in a Hyper-V deployment. So we don't need a NIC team. We can also start to converge RDMA, which means I can deploy virtual NICs in the host connected to the virtual switch that are responsible for SMB traffic like live migration, redirected I/O, storage replication, which we'll talk about later, and live migration. And I can apply DCB or data center bridging to prioritize and allow easy flow of that traffic without congesting the network with one particular service. And I can also do SMB prioritization to even classify the various different types of SMB traffic that my NICs will be sending out. When I am asked to go in and look at a Hyper-V customer, it's usually because something's gone wrong. And a lot of the times I'm asked questions, the performance bottleneck is actually storage. I remember seeing one particular customer who had fantastic hosts from a particular company that made amazing hardware. They had loads of processor, loads of RAM. RAM was probably 20% utilized. Processor was about 1% utilized. However, anytime they started looking at Microsoft Deployment Toolkit and creating boot images in a virtual machine, every one of their virtual machines would grind to a halt. And the reason was their storage system was absolutely rubbish. Storage is the most important thing in virtualization. I don't care what brand of virtualization you use. If your storage is poor, your virtualization was poor, your application services are poor, and you will be poor when your boss lays you off. So get your storage right. One of the challenges we have getting storage right is storage is very often a black art, particularly for us server administrators. And in a larger company, storage administrators don't talk to server administrators. You're getting a RAID 5 array, and you're getting 2 gigs. I know you asked for a terabyte of RAID 10, but that's what I'm giving you. And that's the sort of conversation I've had with storage administrators in the past. With virtualization and cloud, what we're seeing is the network and the storage fabrics are becoming the responsibility of the server administrator. So what we need to do is have easier, ways of managing performance. And what we're getting is distributed storage quality of service. The ability to create policies, which we can then assign to tenants, virtual machines, or virtual hard disks. This allows us to apply minimum IOPS and maximum IOPS rules. And we can deploy various combinations of those to affect individual machines, or groups of machines, or groups of disks. And guarantee service levels and cap performance. So you may be in an environment where a particular virtual machine is hogging IOPS, and you need to cap that so other virtual machines can get a fair shot at the storage subsystem. You may be working in a hosting company where you'll say, listen, we're giving you 500 IOPS for your data disks. Each data disk gets 500 IOPS minimum and maximum. It's funny because Azure does that with its standard A-series virtual machines. You can recreate that sort of effect using distributed storage QoS. It works with scale-out file server and works with SAN. The catch here, you must be working with cluster shared volumes on a Hyper-V cluster. So, first demo, fingers crossed. Let's see how this goes. So all my demos are automated using PowerShell, and you can't see a thing because we seem to have gone into a different view. So let's have a look. There we go. So distributed storage QoS run with PowerShell. So Rick talked earlier about the importance of PowerShell. It was great to see how many hands went up to say, yeah, we're doing PowerShell. But when you come to events like this, I think you get a different type of audience. You get people who are more informed, more willing to learn. Whereas you go into the greater world, you find fewer people putting up their hands. At least that's my experience. Maybe you guys in the UK are way ahead of us in Ireland. I hope so, because we're pretty poor at learning PowerShell. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to create a storage policy. And first, what I'm going to do is make sure you can actually see what we're doing. Let's increase that up, font, and 20. There we go. So we'll create a storage policy. And you're going to see all the PowerShell commands in here for doing all this stuff. So I'm going to create a policy using new storage clause policy. I'm going to give it a name of demo policy 1. And I'm going to say it's multi-instance. So I can do multi-instance or single instance. Do I want to share the IOPS between all the machines that are hitting this policy, or do I want each one to get that policy and have that level of IOPS? So now I can query the details. So I've set it to say minimum IOPS of 100, maximum IOPS of 500. So I have my policy ID. Keep an eye on that ID. And we can see that we've got maximum IOPS of 500, so everything's okay. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to launch Performance Monitor on this host, where I'm running the client UI. Thank you, Mr. Snover. And I'm going to run disk speed within the virtual machine. If you want to stress test Hyper-V virtual machines or Windows machines for storage, use disk speed. Free tool from Microsoft, really easy to set up and use. I am currently hitting 26,000 IOPS on this storage system from that virtual machine. What I'm going to do is I'm going to assign my policy to the virtual hard disk to that virtual machine. I created a policy, now I'm going to assign the policy. So now, if we go back to Performance Monitor, we will see that about a second or two later, my IOPS dropped from 26,000 down to 500. And I took control of that virtual machine. And I can apply that policy across my entire infrastructure. And if that tenant pays me a bit more money, maybe I give them 600 IOPS. They give me a little bit more money, I might put them back to 26,000. So that's distributed storage QoS. And you may have seen demonstrations of that in the past with scale-out file server. I was doing it there with a SAN, actually it's a virtual SAN made by Starwind, and I was hitting 26,000 IOPS. By the way, that was running on a RAID 5 array with SATA disks. So that's about as bad a storage physical subsystem as you can get. And on a very old server as well. Now, while we're talking about storage, the topic of storage came up in the Q&A of the previous session. Was it over here? Someone asked about Storage Spaces Direct and Nano Server and stuff like that. So Microsoft have been giving us a way to do software-defined storage since Server 2012. How many people here have deployed Storage Spaces in production? Wow, that's way more hands than I normally see. That was about 8 or 10 hands. So storage spaces gives us an alternative to RAID, where we can aggregate disks in a JBOD array. So very cheap commodity hardware, pick the disks of our choosing, aggregate it and get the similar effects of RAID, but designed for scalability. RAID has kind of reached its maximums in terms of scalability. Then we could build something called a scale-out file server using Windows Server. We could build this continuously available file services structure for sharing storage spaces to Hyper-V and applications like SQL Server. Not designed for end users' data, intended for applications, and then we could put the end user stuff inside those applications. So a virtual machine stored on a scale-out file server could be a file server for our end users. The architecture of a scale-out file server solution involves Hyper-V clusters or hosts, accessing over SMB3 network, hopefully using RDMA, known as SMB Direct in the Microsoft world, a scale-out file server cluster, typically 2 or 4 nodes, and then on the back end of the scale-out file server cluster, shared SAS-attached JBODs. And a solution of that could be anywhere from a 2U cluster in a box that might have 12 disks, all the way up to a solution that might have 4 or 5 UJ bods sharing 1.6 petabytes of raw storage. I've actually got a customer in Northern Ireland who has that sort of installation. It came in a quarter of the price of their legacy SAN and offered more performance. So that was an easy decision for them. And Microsoft looked at that and said, you know, that's a great solution. It allows us to scale in a certain way, but there's other customers out there who want a different type of design. And what we'd like to do is get away from SAS disks. SAS disks are expensive. What we want to do is still give people flash storage for their hot working set data, because Storage Spaces does tiered storage. We want to give them that. We want to give them new types of flash storage, non-volatile memory express or NVMe. And we want to have those big, cheap 8 terabyte SATA disks. So what they did was they put those disks into servers and striped a shared virtual shared SAS bus across those disks, thus aggregating those 4 servers you see on the right-hand side. Now this can scale out in technical preview 3 up to 12 servers, minimum of 4. And what you're getting is something similar to what you may have seen from some SAN solutions in the past. Those 4 servers are working as one. Each server is an enclosure, so when blocks of data are written to an enclosure, they're also written to other enclosures, depending on the storage fault tolerance that you implement. And those servers are the SAN. So you're talking about simple 2U servers using NVMe for really fast IOPS and SATA disk for big, cheap, cold data storage. And Microsoft did a demonstration of that recently using some servers at an event, and they hit 4.2 million 4K read IOPS, which is pretty ridiculous. What was the bottleneck? CPU. Not the network, not the disks, not Windows Server, the CPU. So we're seeing something new happen in the last year or so. Who here has heard of hyperconvergence? That's about half the hands. So there are certain brands out there like Nutanix and GridStore and Simplivity who are making the most of this concept. The idea is, instead of putting in compute clusters and storage networks, why don't we just put in servers that have disks, and that's it, a turnkey solution. And those things can cost a lot of money. But the pitch, and they're selling, the pitch to the C-level executives is, this is a turnkey deployment of virtualization. It's not a risky project. We literally put in some rack servers, we turn them on, the stuff just works. Microsoft are going to give us that as well with Storage Spaces Direct. So you can buy your servers from your typical vendors, don't have to pay 6 times more for the same hardware off of certain brands, and you'll be able to deploy Hyper-V clusters with Storage Spaces Direct, sharing the disks and doing fault tolerance between the enclosures across that cluster. This is going to really shake up things when Windows Server 2016 comes out. And the disks will be NVMe, SSD, and SATA. And they overcome the limitations of SATA using that virtual SAS adapter, or bus, excuse me. So we all want more uptime, more availability. And when we have to patch something, we get given out to, when we respond to a customer saying, hey, I want more memory in my virtual machine, and we have to reboot it to do that, they give out to us. So we want to solve all those problems. And Microsoft hear the feedback, and they want to solve those problems too. Shared VHDX was given to us in 2012. Great feature. The idea here is when we want to create a failover cluster using virtual machines, in the past we've had to supply iSCSI or virtual fiber channel disks, which crosses the line between tenant and infrastructure or fabric. And those of us in the hosting business or who apply some of those concepts into private deployments really don't like that stuff. We like everything to be software defined because it's flexible and easy to move around. So Microsoft gave us shared VHDX, but the problem was it wasn't flexible and it couldn't be moved around. We basically got version 1 of the technology. 2016, we're getting version 2 of the technology. So Microsoft heard the feedback, they stack ranked it, and they said, okay, we're going to give you these two items. We're giving you online resizing of shared VHDX. So if you deploy a shared VHDX of 1 terabyte to store some database files and the database grows and it fills the disk, we can expand the disk. And we don't have to shut down the guest cluster to do that, because service uptime is important. And we also importantly get host-based backup of that cluster, including the shared VHDX. Really important, because we do like to back up our valuable services. And we don't want to be shutting down those services to back them up. So this will simplify backup in that scenario. A lot of outages we see out there in the real world are caused by little transient things. A switch port flapping, an operator pulling the wrong network cable, storage having a bit of a flutter and causing all our virtual machines to crash. So Microsoft are trying to abstract those issues, not hide the fact that they happen, because those issues will be logged, but to allow the virtual machines that we're running to survive those issues. So the first thing we get is storage resiliency. So if your storage, physical storage subsystem goes offline, virtual machines will notice that IOPS stop and Hyper-V will pause those virtual machines. In the past, what would have happened? The virtual machines would have panicked and crashed. So pausing the virtual machines, it waits for the storage to come back online, and then it just simply unpauses the virtual machines and they continue from where they were. No IOPS lost. Is that perfect? No, but who do we have to blame for that? The storage vendor. So talk to the storage vendor. At least Hyper-V is surviving that particular issue. Clusters are based on heartbeats. So if one node fails to heartbeat, normal experience is it's assumed dead and all the virtual machines fail over to the other nodes in the cluster. A failover process involves the virtual machine having to boot from cold all over again. A lot of failovers are caused by these transient errors. Network issues are typically a big cause here. So what Microsoft are doing are saying, okay, we're trying to find the right sweet spot between failover and not failover. So we're getting a configurable setting here where we can isolate a host in the event of it failing to heartbeat. And we can reduce this down if we want, but by default, a host will wait up to 4 minutes before it fails over virtual machines to other hosts. And Microsoft are saying, well, we think that's about the time it takes for a switch to reboot and come fully back online again. So that's what they've based it on. But you can reduce that or expand that based on your own experience. If a host is isolated 3 times in 1 hour, it will be quarantined. This basically means that virtual machines will be live migrated off the host, and no virtual machines will be placed onto that host until it comes out of quarantine. And that allows operators or administrators to start figuring out, okay, why is this thing flapping? So it might be move it to a different switch port, replace the switch, replace the cables, patch the host, or even do the Snover thing, shoot the host in the head and rebuild it. And I suppose if you're running Nano Server, that'll be quick to deploy. We do get asked to add resources to virtual machines. And one of those big resources we're asked to tune is memory. Now, if you're using dynamic memory, that's great because you can set a very high maximum amount of memory and we can increase that and we can decrease minimum memory as well. But a lot of big workloads do not use dynamic memory. The reason being is when we use dynamic memory, we lose NUMA alignment. In other words, we get suboptimal performance of the physical memory for that virtual machine. and that can cause performance issues for that virtual machine and other virtual machines on the same host. So those big workloads that have memory that's bigger than the size of a NUMA node, we give static memory. But that means we have inflexible memory. And to change the memory in the past, we've had to shut down the virtual machine, increase it, decrease it, and reboot it again. In 2016, you'll be able to hot add memory to that virtual machine, assuming the host has that memory available, and you'll be able to remove memory from that virtual machine to the point where the virtual machine is not using that memory. So if you try to remove more memory than the virtual machine is capable of releasing, you'll get a warning, and it'll just release what it's capable of releasing. And that'll be there for generation one and generation two virtual machines. We'll also be able to hot add and remove virtual NICs on generation two virtual machines. This will be useful, I suppose, if you're building guest clusters and you need to add virtual networks and stuff like that for communications to SMB3 storage or heartbeats or whatever, or you need to connect virtual machines temporarily onto particular isolated subnets. One nice feature I should mention here, and it's not really to do with hot add or remove, but it is to do with virtual NICs, is that we can identify those virtual NICs when we create them. So we can name the NICs, and we can make that name appear in the guest OS, which we can get at using PowerShell, and we can then rename the network connection in the virtual machine instead of calling it Ethernet 2, which I don't know about you guys, but I find Ethernet 2 does not help me in any way, shape, or form trying to identify the role of that network. So let's have a look at hot adding stuff in a virtual machine. And we need to duplicate. So. I have a virtual machine running, and that virtual machine has way more memory than it's supposed to. What's going on there now? Dynamic memory in a hot add memory. Ah, no. Sorry, I'm reading. The results of the PowerShell command are confusing. We can see dynamic memory enabled is actually set to false, so the virtual machine is using static RAM. And the startup memory is 2 gigs. Maximum RAM is irrelevant because it's got dynamic memory. So the machine has 2 gigs of RAM. So pay attention to the startup memory setting where it says 2048 megs. What I'm going to do is increase that using set VMM memory, and I'm going to set it to 8 gigs. And that's it. There's no reboots. Now when I go and look at the machine, it has 8192 megs, so 8 gigs of RAM. How long has that virtual machine been running? Hopefully more than 5 seconds. It's been running 1 day, 14 hours and 25 minutes, just to prove that we did hot add memory to the virtual machine. Now we will have a look at the NICs in this machine. So I'm going to do some PowerShell remoting, and we see that there is one NIC there that is usefully called Ethernet 7. We can add a NIC using add VM network adapter. Now when I query the virtual machine, I can see that it should have two NICs, one usefully called 7 and the other called 13. Now, the virtual machine network adapter identification stuff only kicks in after you reboot the virtual machine. I expect they'll probably change that, because the hot add stuff is important to us. So, verify the virtual machine has continued to run. So, that's hot add and remove of resources. So, there are multiple ways we can do disaster recovery with Hyper-V. We can do Hyper-V replica to another physical site where we're running Hyper-V. We can do Azure site recovery to Azure. And I heard you're getting two new regions here in the UK. So that'll be a lot of interest to you guys if you don't want to replicate to Amsterdam or Dublin. What's wrong with Dublin? But we've also been using failover clustering. But the problem with doing failover clustering for Dior up to now has been that it has no concept of sites. We basically had a flat failover cluster. A virtual machine could live migrate anywhere. a virtual machine could fail over anywhere. So if we wanted a virtual machine to stay in site A, it could actually end up in site B, where the users weren't and the storage wasn't. So that was bad. So what Microsoft had done is they've given us site-aware failover clustering. And this gives us the ability to logically tag the nodes in our cluster with a site ID. That could be a name, could be a number, it's just some logical tag. And then we can set affinity for our virtual machines to say, you are supposed to be in site one. You are supposed to be in London. You are supposed to be in Glasgow. And you only fail over if that site goes offline. So normal operations for live migrating, cluster-aware updating, and all that stuff will keep those virtual machines within their own site. If a cluster shared volume ownership moves to a different site, the virtual machines will live migrate to follow that, to stop storage traffic crossing the WAN. So that'll optimize how we do things, and we can also tune it using some Heartbeat stuff that's available to us as well. Tied into that is storage replica. How many people here have a SAN at work for Hyper-V? Okay, how many of you have licensing to do synchronous replication to another site? And how many of you think that licensing was expensive? Same hands. Now it's going to be built into Windows Server. So get built-in synchronous volume replication. So if you want to do it from a scale-out file server, or you want to do volume replication from hosts that are attached to a SAN, you'll be able to do that. No additional SAN licensing required from the SAN vendors. That will probably start eating into their 85% margins when they have to start discounting their SAN licensing costs. So this will be supported by Hyper-V and failover clustering, and ties in very nicely with the site-aware failover clustering functionality. So now we can do synchronous replication of our VMs running in site A to or from London to another site called Newcastle. When we fail over, we have zero data loss. This requires 10 gig or faster networking. It's built on SMB3 networking, so if you've got RDMA or rootable RDMA, this will be useful. I did say 10 gig. So this is aimed at big business. This is not for the SMEs. Cluster rolling upgrade. I love this feature. This is one of the headline features of 2016. A lot of enterprises out there are still running older versions of Hyper-V. Not because of licensing, but because of the fear of upgrading from 2008 R2 to 2012 or 2012 R2. Because you just could not do an in-place upgrade of a cluster. You had to build a new cluster and move your virtual machines from the old cluster to the new cluster. Now, Microsoft gave us ways of minimizing that downtime. In fact, from 2012 to 2012 R2, we could do it with zero downtime across versional live migration. Cluster rolling upgrade allows us to take a node in the cluster. It has to be a 2012 R2 cluster. We can take that first node, evict it from the drain it of virtual machines, evict it from the cluster, rebuild it with 2016, and add it back to the old 2012 R2 cluster. And it could participate in live migration and failover clustering. The whole process is like an Active Directory upgrade. The cluster will effectively run at a 2012 R2 schema level or functional level. And when we've gone through each of the hosts, we can upgrade the cluster to 2016 functional level with a single PowerShell commandlet. And then we can increase the version of the virtual machines to version 6. And then we will have all the 2016 functionality across the entire environment with zero downtime. And that's important, because we've got to get used to the concept of Windows as a service, and Microsoft giving us releases very, very frequently. And we will want the functionality they give us. Operational improvements have continued through the last few versions. Checkpoints, formerly known as snapshots. Who's using snapshots for backup? Oh, take those two people and shoot them. Snapshots or checkpoints in Hyper-V are not intended for backup. And the term has, unfortunately, snapshots has been overused, like the phrase domain. That's why a few of us campaigned to get Microsoft to copy the nomenclature from System Center Virtual Machine Manager and call them checkpoints. So people didn't start thinking, hey, this is a way of backing up. Snapshots are typically not supported by anything running in the virtual machine. Even though Hyper-V supports snapshots or checkpoints, SQL doesn't, Exchange doesn't, Active Directory doesn't, all bad stuff. So Microsoft are worried because everyone's moving to a DevOps type, well, not everyone, a lot of people are moving to a DevOps type way of dealing with software. And that means continuously changing software. I like to call it continuously crappy software. But the software is going to be constantly changing. And the operators are going to checkpoint a VM, upgrade the software, and then get rid of the checkpoint. Or if the upgrade did went poorly, they'll remove the checkpoint and go back to an older version. That's going to cause problems if the checkpoints or the snapshot process didn't give us VSS consistency, which is what production checkpoints, the default checkpoint type in 2016, will do. So we'll have VSS consistency applied by VSS within the guest OS itself. And when we restore a checkpoint, it's like restoring the VM from backup. So the VM will boot up cold, not from where it was when the checkpoint was created, but it will boot up from cold, and you'll be guaranteed that things like SQL Server and Exchange Server will all be consistent. Speaking of backup, Hyper-V has had a lot of negative feedback on backup. 2012 OR2, they moved towards file-based backup. In 2016, they will improve that by offloading some of the orchestration to the backup application itself, or the backup requester. The other thing they're doing is removing the need for the backup vendors to implement a file system filter in the kernel mode of the management OS of the hosts. Because Microsoft do not like stuff being added to the kernel on hosts, because it can affect performance and be buggy and stuff like that. So we're getting resilient change tracking. So we get block-based change tracking of our virtual hard disks in 2016. Built in there for the backup vendors to actually leverage, so they can do reliable incremental backups of our virtual machines rather than full backups. Anyone here using a SAN that has offloaded data transfer enabled, ODX? Okay. Who likes it? No hands. Oh, one hand. You're a compelling customer, maybe. A lot of ODX was introduced in 2012 to take advantage of functionality that a hardware SAN could offer, or even a software SAN, where certain disk transactions, like creating a fixed virtual hard disk, which is very IOPS intensive, could be offloaded to the SAN, and we get a near instant result. We saw three types of offering from SAN vendors. Ones that worked, reliable, and actually did improve performance. Ones that didn't do anything for us, and ones that corrupted our virtual machines. And unfortunately, the latter ones are very common. So what Microsoft are doing is they've taken their next generation file system, which in 2016 is our current generation file system. It's the one Microsoft wants us to use with Cluster Shared Volume, or EFS, Resilient File System. And they're giving us accelerated VHDX operations. So the ability to offload things like creating a fixed virtual hard disk, which could take minutes or hours, and now takes seconds. Or merging a checkpoint, something that's important for backup and for production checkpoints in the DevOps world. Now, I was going to do a demo of this, but I'm short on time, so we'll keep moving. In fact, I see Ed coming up to kick me off. Let's move on very quickly. Azure Stack gives us the Microsoft Azure Consistent Cloud. We can take the portal of Azure, the Abitha portal, and run it on-premise. We can run Azure Consistent Networking with the network controller, so built-in load balancing, built-in distributed firewalling, new VPN gateways, and support for VXLAN and NVGRE for software-defined networking. We'll also get Azure Consistent Storage, so the ability to deploy blobs and tables on scale-out file servers. So the same sort of experience you get in Azure that you can run on-premise or in a hosting company. You can run the same PowerShell, the same ARM templates that Rick's going to be talking about in the last time slot. This thing is Azure on-prem or in a hosting company. And this should be very interesting for you mid to large organizations or you hosting partners. And lastly, containers. Who's heard of Docker? Who knows what Docker is? Okay. So 5 minutes to go. Brilliant. I can do a demo. If we think about the history of deploying applications, we got our server, we installed Windows NT4 on it, and then we installed 10 different services onto it, and we wondered why it was buggy. And then 2000 and 2003 came along, and we learned one physical server, one application. And then we started using virtualization for the first time. And we started realizing, you know what? These physical servers, they take a week to a month to acquire and deploy. Virtual machines, hey, we can deploy one of them really quickly. So we can deploy a virtual machine with one operating system, one application, very, very quickly. And as time has gone by with templating, that could be, and automation, we could get that down to, you know, under an hour, realistically. But you know what? Our customers, our employers, the people who deploy applications on the infrastructure that we use, want to be able to deploy applications in seconds. So So virtualization that we've been using, like Hyper-V, is machine virtualization. Containers is operating system virtualization. And the goal here is we move away from one operating system, one application, or one machine, one application. We go to one operating system, one application, with multiple operating system instances running in one machine. That's the way to think of it. So we have in our typical operating system kernel mode and user mode. Windows processes and application processes running in user mode. Windows Server Containers is an similar implementation to Linux containers. Docker manages containers. And Docker, Microsoft are working very closely with them. Docker will manage Linux containers and Windows Server containers. The idea here is we have one shared kernel mode and we have multiple operating system instances. Now, Windows Server containers, those operating system instances running in user mode, so they share the same kernel. So there is application isolation here. I could run a web server in each of those containers, and I could have 100 containers in one machine, and each of those web servers is isolated in terms of application. However, they share the same kernel. So we do not have secure isolation with containers, be it Linux containers or Windows Server containers. Microsoft happens to have a containerization solution that does give secure isolation, and it's Hyper-V. So the next step up is Hyper-V containers, where a virtual machine, no, it's not a virtual machine. A Hyper-V container is deployed with a stripped down, optimized version of Windows that will boot in seconds. And in there, it will have kernel mode and container user mode. And we can deploy that thing in seconds, and it's the images that we use to create these containers are interchangeable with the Windows Server containers, and the technology will be manageable using PowerShell and Docker. And we'll be able to deploy this on-prem and in Azure. A side effect of this is we're finally getting something we all want in the Hyper-V world, nested Hyper-V. The ability to run a Hyper-V host on a Hyper-V host and run the virtual machines in there. Me, I love that concept. I'll be able to take a portable demo lab and to show clusters and storage and everything wherever I go. I don't have to remote back to Dublin anymore. So I'll have reliable demo labs, hopefully. I think in the hosting world, it's going to be interesting because we'll be able to take something like Azure or Rackspace or whatever and have a public cloud and run a private cloud on a public cloud using nested virtualization. The ideas here are just ridiculous. And when Microsoft finally, you can try this out using Windows 10 if you're on the preview builds. When it comes out on server, you will see the performance is actually surprisingly spectacular. And Microsoft's goals are just even better again. This stuff is something to watch out for. So containers, we'll have one quick demo before we wrap up and before Ed kicks me off. So run this with PowerShell. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna create a container from an image. So we can build up images and we'll show those images in a second. So the PowerShell, you can't see this. Silly me. The PowerShell that I'm using to deploy this is actually some of the most intuitive PowerShell I've seen from Microsoft. So I've done new container, I've given it a name, I've told it what virtual switch in this VM to connect to. My VM is running a switch. And I've selected an image from a repository of images. So I have these reusable images that are linked and nested. I've started the container. Now I can look at what's in the container. I can see that container webcon 1 is running, and it's based on an image called custom nginx. So I'm actually running a open source web server in this Windows Server container. And it's based on custom nginx, so let's have a look at custom nginx. It's based on nginx, and nginx is based on a container OS called Windows Server Core. So that's the virtualized operating system that I deployed, and then I layered different images on top of it. But to deploy my images, I only picked the top level one. I didn't have to say deploy Windows Server Core, deploy Nginx, deploy custom Nginx. I literally just said deploy custom Nginx, and all the dependencies automatically deployed. And when I say deploy, it literally just linked. No files were actually moved or copied. So that's how it's so fast to deploy. So now I'm going to configure networking. I have two options. I can use DHCP, so my containers go onto the network, broadcast, and get a DHCP address. Or if I want true scalability, I can use NAT, Network Address Translation. So my VM has one IP address, and I will share out ports on that IP address for my containers. So if anything comes in on port TCP 60002, it will go to container one. Anything on 60003, go to container two. 60004, go to container three. So the number of containers I can put on here is based on the amount of resources in my VM and the amount of TCP ports I've got available on that VM. So this is how we can truly scale out and not have to worry about the network and those guys starving us of IP addresses. And now I can deploy out. Hey, let's deploy out another container. And you know what? More containers, start those containers. You can see this stuff is fast. It takes a second or two to create a new container. It takes a few seconds for that container to boot up with an application already ready to rock and roll. And then you can use your desired state configuration or anything else to configure that container up the way you want it. Containers, something for you guys in the developer world, working with developers or in large enterprises, you'll really want to pay attention to. So that's been a bit of a speed run through Windows Server 2016 Hyper-V. There is a lot more to this. This has literally just been some highlights. There's way, way more we could have talked about. Unfortunately, we didn't have the time, and I've been told to get off, and the music's about to play.